Welcome back to EVR 2858. We are now at Lecture 8, the Clean Air Act, and this is Part 1. By the end of this lecture, you should be able to describe the race to laxity, what NAAQS means, 7 criteria pollutants, a hazardous pollutant under the CAA, what a stationary source is according to the CAA, non-attainment areas, emissions trading programs, and noise pollution under the CAA. So, some background. Air and water are common resources and are sometimes referred to by lay people as pollution sinks, implying that airsheds and water bodies are large vats into which pollutants can be thrown as a large disposal. As we saw with the Clean Water Act, this isn't true. While both airsheds and water bodies can handle some amount of pollution without significant degradation, airsheds and water bodies can't handle uncontrolled amounts of pollution. That is, there is something to the statement that the solution to pollution is dilution. However, this is not a preferred approach to cleaning the environment. In 1970, Congress passed the Clean Air Act amendments, referred to as the CAA or Clean Air Act. Before the 1970 CAA, Congress primarily focused on providing funds to defray the large capital costs of pollution control facilities and on providing various forms of technical expertise. If a downwind state was having bad impacts from upwind state pollution, the federal government didn't have much enforcement authority beyond requesting the upwind state to enforce relevant upwind state laws. There was little to no federal involvement in direct pollution control. The race to laxity. Now, some states tried to enact strict air pollution control laws, but were trumped by the race to laxity. This is where states having more stringent pollution control standards found themselves disadvantaged in the competition for economic development. States with less pollution controls would offer businesses sweetheart deals, including further relaxation of the limited standards already in place, or no oversight to really impose the limited standards. Note, we're studying how the CAA essentially eliminates this problem from the U.S., but we still see an analogous issue in international environmental laws. For example, in 2008, China took huge temporary steps to curb air pollution in advance of the 2008 Summer Olympics. They actually did majorly reduce their air pollution, but once the Olympics were over, it's gone back to higher levels. So Congress takes action. After reviewing the sorry state of the nation's air quality and the increase in respiratory problems among a variety of groups, Congress took action and passed the Clean Air Act amendments of 1970. The amendments of 70, as also amended in 77 and 90, embodies a combination of 4 distinct statutory techniques. Sections 7407, 7408, 7409, and 7410, taken together, created the broad basic workhorse regulatory system for control of the most commonly produced and significant air pollution. These sections apply a harm-based ambient quality regulatory approach to stationary sources. In English, a strategy to regulate fixed sources of air pollution based on a combination of background air quality and any changes to air quality that may cause harm. Other sections worth knowing about is 7411, which is new sources of air pollution and best technology for emissions, and 7412, strategy for regulating hazardous air pollutants. So, section 7407 deals with air quality control regions. Pause and read it. And we're back. So what does this say in English? Each state is responsible for all the air over the state. They are required to create a single or multiple state implementation plans. A SIP spells out methods used to achieve the National Primary and Secondary Ambient Air Quality Standards, or NAAQS. The same as with the Clean Water Act, the state is responsible for ensuring that the federal standards are covered at the state level, and spells out how such NAAQS will be maintained within each air quality control region of the state. Section 7411 applies to new sources of air pollution and establishes a system of best technology emissions requirements following a technology-based standard-setting approach. Note, as with the Clean Water Act, technology-based standards reflect the best cleaning capability of technology at the time. Section 7412. This section originally called for uniform harm-based national emission standards for hazardous air pollutants. This effort, based on attempts to weigh hazards to health, proved wholly unsatisfactory. Part of this lack of success was that health hazards may differ for different parts of the country. As a conceptual analogy, think of a very faint smoky smell. In a dry air location, that smoky smell might be very light, but maybe heavier in a very humid environment where the smell lingers. While this is a hypothetical description, it gives you a better feel for why a single standard applied across 3.5 million square miles of the U.S. may not work. In 1990, Congress shifted Section 7412 to a technology-based strategy for regulating hazardous air pollutants. Non-attainment areas. There are areas in the U.S. that are unable to attain the primary NAAQS, and these are referred to as non-attainment areas. Here is what one looks like. And yes, California appears to have some of the most prevalent non-attainment areas. So they've got, just for this one, is ozone. The EPA has what they call the Green Book that lists the non-attainment areas for criteria pollutants. The website is at epa.gov/greenbook. This page lists NAAQS for ozone, sulfur dioxide, carbon monoxide, particulate matter, lead, nitrogen dioxide, as well as national multi-pollutant areas. There are a number of standards here, and you can see when standards were updated. For instance, for sulfur dioxide, there is a 1971 standard and a 2010 standard. The carbon dioxide standard was promulgated in 1971. But if you check the Green Book page, it notes that the areas were designated in 1990. The Green Book page states that, as of September 27, 2010, all carbon monoxide areas have been redesignated to maintenance. You may ask why some standards have not been updated. All NAAQS come under review every 5 years. Ozone was last updated 2015, sulfur dioxide in 2010, particulate matter 2.5 microns in 2012. So the federal government's role. In enacting the 1970 amendments, Congress offered the states a partnership in a new regulatory regime for clean air termed cooperative federalism. States could retain their long-standing primacy as regulators of the local entities that caused air pollution by adopting state implementation plans, or SIPs, that would assure attainment of the NAAQS. Overall, a specific implementation strategy, but the endpoint is not dramatically different than what was conceived for the CWA implementation by the states. The federal government's role would be threefold. One, it would set the standards that must be met. Two, it would review state implementation plans to ensure that plans would result in the attainment of the mandated degrees of air quality. And three, it would supplant the states as primary regulators if the states failed to act or acted in a way that would not ensure attainment. So harm-based standards. Harm-based standards, what level of pollution causes harm to human health, are perfectly matched to the vision of cooperative federalism. The federal government could set the goal with reference to relatively objective criteria, the NAAQS primary standards, and what level of pollution causes harm to welfare in the environment, the NAAQS secondary standards. Here's the concept. The states, more familiar with their own needs and the capabilities of the polluters within their borders, would have the freedom and the responsibility to make the difficult and multifaceted determinations about how to limit pollution to the allowable upper boundary. The national need is served because the unacceptable harm to health and welfare is eliminated. The states retain their sovereign prerogatives in managing and accommodating the competing interests of their constituents. Section 7408. I'll let you read that on your own. And we're back, looking at NAAQS another way. Let's take a look at this from another point of view. Although pollution may be deplorable from an aesthetic or environmental point of view, living in a degraded environment can reflect a reasoned choice. Few among us would agree that absolutely no emission of pollution was a livable condition, preferring instead some level of human-produced pollution and material comforts such as AC in the summer, refrigeration for food, automobiles, etc. Why should citizens of the state of filth be denied the economic prosperity of a booming economy and dirty environment if that is their wish? Is concern for the health of filth citizens a significant and sufficient rationale for federal standard setting if the residents of filth decide to forego a safe environment? Whatever the force of the argument against national standards as an invasion of filth's right to be filthy, this argument's strength is reduced dramatically should filth fail to stay at home. The air and water into which most industrial effluents are discharged circulate and carry pollutants downwind and downstream, imposing social costs on people far from those living in the state of origin. If the external costs of filth can be controlled, beyond concern for the health of filth citizens, a second national interest that justifies imposing national ambient air quality standards results in avoiding the problem of the race of laxity. So how do you determine the standards? Two controversial threshold decisions that must be made in adopting harm-based ambient standards involve: one, what harms are significant enough to justify the subsequent burden of regulation, and two, the correlation of cause and effect, i.e., the linkage of a particular ambient quality level with the avoidance of harm. The Clean Air Act has two approaches, harm-based and technology-based controls, depending on which pollutant we are focusing on at the time. There are the criteria pollutants, which are some of the most common and widely generated pollutants, principally those emitted by the combustion of fossil fuels. Section 7408A1A-B defines criteria pollutants generically as those that cause and contribute to air pollution, which may reasonably be anticipated to endanger public health or welfare, the presence of which in the ambient air results from numerous or diverse mobile or stationary sources. So Section 7408A says, air quality criteria for an air pollutant accurately reflect the latest scientific knowledge about effects on public health or welfare, and the criteria for an air pollutant, to the extent practicable, notice we've got practicable, not possible, shall include information on factors, including atmospheric conditions, which of themselves or in combination with other factors may alter the effects on public health or welfare of such air pollutant. B, the types of air pollutants which, when present in the atmosphere, may interact with such pollutant to produce an adverse effect on public health or welfare, and any known or anticipated adverse effects on welfare. Now, where are these standards listed? Well, Section 7409 sets out national primary and secondary ambient air quality standards. National ambient air quality standards are often referred to as NAACs, pronounced NAACs, and subsection A deals with the time frame in which the EPA administrator must promulgate the standards. The linchpin here is subsection B. So section 7409, subsection B, parts 1 and 2, defines the qualitative effect that adherence to the standards will have. Part 1, National Primary Ambient Air Quality Standards. These are requisite to protect the public health. Part 2 is National Secondary Ambient Air Quality Standards, and this is requisite to protect the public welfare from any known or anticipated adverse effects. So how are standards determined? Standard setting requires judgments about the causal effects of exposure to varying concentrations of pollutants. Ambient air quality standards are described in terms of maximum concentrations that are applicable for various time periods and that are not to be exceeded more than a specified number of times, usually once, if at all, on an annual basis. It must also be noted that economic feasibility has no role to play in the standard-setting process under the harm-based ambient quality approach. Look at the statute. It says nothing about economic feasibility. If a state wants to look at feasibility when designing a state implementation plan, the state may do so, but not to the point where attainment of the NAAQS will be compromised. If states cut no slack for polluters on feasibility grounds, that is taken as an indication that the state either 1. Intends to put its polluters on the spot to innovate or shut down, or 2. Cannot draft a SIP that will attain the NAAQS without placing some of its polluters in that uncomfortable position. We need to note that the EPA has discretion to reject feasibility allowances in SIPs if, in EPA's judgment, the SIPs do not achieve attainment as quickly as would still be practicable with lesser allowances for feasibility. So the 7 current NAAQS for criteria pollutants. The current standards are set forth in Title 40 of the Code of Federal Regulations, sections 50.4 to 50.12. The criteria pollutants are sulfur oxides, particulate matter 10, referred to as PM10, which are particles with an aerodynamic diameter less than or equal to a nominal 10 micrometers, particulate matter 2.5, referred to as PM2.5, which are particles with an aerodynamic diameter less than or equal to a nominal 2.5 micrometers, carbon monoxide, ozone, nitrogen dioxide, and lead. So NAAQS examples. 40 CFR section 50.4 sets out the primary standard for sulfur oxides. The annual level is to be 0.030 parts per million per calendar year. The 24-hour standard is 0.14 parts per million, not to be exceeded more than once per calendar year. Note that this says calendar year. It sets out when the clock starts and when it stops, January 1st through December 31st. It is not a tax year, i.e. April 15th to April 14th, and it is not a fiscal year, October 1st to September 30th. The secondary standard spelled out in section 50.5 for sulfur oxides calls for a 3-hour standard of 0.5 parts per million, not to be exceeded more than once per calendar year. Section 50.6 deals with both the primary and secondary standards for PM10, or particles with an aerodynamic diameter less than or equal to a nominal 10.0 micrometers, think dusts, pollens, molds. The primary and secondary standards are 150 micrograms per cubic meter in a 24-hour average concentration. Section 50.7 deals with particulate matter with particles with an aerodynamic diameter less than or equal to a nominal 2.5 micrometers. Think combustion particles or organic compounds. Section 50.7a states the national primary and secondary ambient air quality standards for particulate matter are 15.0 micrograms per cubic meter, annual arithmetic mean concentration, and 65 micrograms per cubic meter in a 24-hour average concentration measured in the ambient air as PM2.5. As you can tell, they are literally splitting hairs here. Carbon monoxide is covered in section 50.8, with the primary standard being 9 parts per million for an 8-hour average and 35 parts per million for a 1-hour average. Both of these standards are not to be exceeded more than once per year. Ozone shows up in section 50.9. The 1-hour primary and secondary standards are 0.12 parts per million. The standard is attained when the expected number of days per calendar year with maximum hourly average concentrations are above 0.12 parts per million is equal to or less than 1. So if an area exceeded the 1-hour limit 23 times in 1 year, that area has attained the NAAQS for ozone. But in section 50.10, there is the 8-hour ozone limits. The 8-hour limits are applied when the 1-hour limits have been continuously met. The 8-hour limit is 0.08 parts per million, daily maximum 8-hour average. So, averaged over a whole 24-hour day, the ozone cannot exceed 0.08 parts per million. The nitrogen dioxide primary standard is 0.053 parts per million, and the secondary standard is the same as spelled out in section 50.11. And last but not least is lead. Section 50.12 sets out the primary and secondary lead standards to be 1.5 micrograms per cubic meter, maximum arithmetic mean averaged over a calendar quarter. Where can we find some of this information? Well, try the Weather Channel for ozone alerts. Here's a map from the National Weather Services. You can also go to NASA for air quality information as well. Find particulate matter of less than 2.5 microns in width. PM2.5 is directly emitted into the atmosphere, such as in the form of smoke and dust. PM2.5 can also form in the atmosphere through chemical reactions that transform gaseous precursor pollutants, such as sulfur dioxide, ammonia, and nitrogen dioxide, to particles, gas to particle conversion. Satellite data indicate that PM2.5 levels have decreased by about 30% or more over the eastern U.S. from 1998 to 2012 because of emission control measures. It's really pretty cool that NASA's working on this. So surface PM2.5 levels, as inferred from NASA's satellite data, have decreased about 30%. The spatial distributions of annual pollutants are shown for 2003 and 2016 here in this picture. So what's the difference between primary and secondary NACs? The difference between them is the timeline for achieving the standards. Section 7410A2A requires that SIPs must be able to meet primary standards as expeditiously as practicable, but in no case later than 3 years from the date of EPA approval of such plan, whereas SIPs need only specify a reasonable time at which such secondary standards will be attained. This difference in treatment has had the practical effect of making the secondary standards more of a desideratum than an enforceable part of the act. So the EPA administrator comes up with the NACs, and then it goes to the states for them to come up with drafting the state implementation plans to come up with a plan to attain the NACs. All right, Section 7410, state implementation plans. So it says each state shall adopt and submit a plan which provides for implementation, maintenance, and enforcement of such primary standard in each air quality control region within such state. Unless a separate public hearing is provided, each state shall consider its plan implementing such secondary standard at the hearing required by the first sentence of this paragraph. One thing to note is that states are given 3 years after NACs are established to accomplish this. So Section 7410C, this section says the administrator shall, has no choice, shall promulgate a federal implementation plan at any time within 2 years after the administrator finds that a state has failed to make a required SIP, or the state plan or plan revision does not satisfy the minimum criteria established under subsection K1A of this section, or B, disapproves a state implementation plan submission in whole or in part, unless the state corrects the deficiency and the administrator approves the plan or plan revision before the administrator promulgates such federal implementation plan. So, did the states meet the deadline? Most states managed to draft SIPs that have met with EPA approval. A very notable example of a state that did not manage to draft an approvable SIP is Ohio. The EPA added sulfur dioxide emissions to the list of criteria pollutants. Once a pollutant is added to the list of criteria pollutants, the states have a fixed timeline, i.e. the 3 years, within which to propose a SIP. Now, Ohio proposed a SIP for SO2, but was sued by an emitter over an issue of administrative law. Ohio dropped the initial SIP and then came up with another one that was submitted to the EPA for approval. The second SIP was legally challenged, and the proposed SIP was withdrawn after the challenge was upheld by the state court. So by mid-1975, Ohio had no SIP for sulfur dioxide. The EPA stepped in and created a SIP and imposed it on Ohio as allowed under federal law. 32 companies filed multiple suits against the EPA SIP. Ohio moved to intervene. The court allowed Ohio to intervene, but struck down Ohio's arguments and complaints. What and why? One of the main issues of the case was that the EPA used the Real-Time Air Quality Simulation Model, or RAM, in order to come up with the SIP. The companies complained that the RAM model wasn't the best possible approach to determining standards or the control of SO2 emissions. The court noted that most of the companies who filed suit attended open meetings with the EPA to complain about the previous model used, and that a new model was needed to be more specific to each smokestack and each area individually. The companies allowed the EPA to take measurements to have a database to form a new model. The court noted that it was not empowered to determine if the RAM model was the best possible approach to control SO2 emissions, but reviewed the agency action to determine if it was arbitrary, capricious, or an abuse of discretion. The court determined that the EPA's actions were rational and not arbitrary. The companies also complained that the EPA did not take cost and technical feasibility into consideration when designing the SIP. The court noted that the law did not allow the EPA to take costs or technological feasibility into consideration when coming up with the SIP, and that only the air quality was to be taken into account when forming a SIP. As mentioned before, Section 7411 applies to new sources. So what does Congress mean when it says new source? Well, it says here the term standard of performance means a standard for emissions of air pollutants, which reflects the degree of emissions limitation achievable through the application of the best system of emission reduction, which, taking into account the cost of achieving such reduction and any non-air quality, health, and environmental impact and energy requirements, the administrator deems has been adequately demonstrated. New source means any stationary source, the construction or modification of which is commenced after the publication of regulations, or if earlier proposed regulations, prescribing a standard of performance under this section which will be applicable to such source. Then we have stationary source. It means any building, structure, facility, or installation which emits or may emit any air pollutant. This does not apply to stationary internal combustion engines, by the way. So if you look at this, the building, structure, facility, or installation is the same language that we find in the Clean Water Act. And where in the world would you find a stationary internal combustion engine? Well, in South Florida, they're what is used when it's necessary to pump water through the canals. The term modification means any physical change in or change in the method of operation of a stationary source which increases the amount of any air pollutant emitted by such source or which results in the emission of any air pollutant not previously emitted. So subsection B requires the administrator to create classifications of stationary sources. Hazardous air pollutants. These were originally defined as pollutants other than criteria pollutants, the exposure to which is reasonably anticipated to result in the increase in mortality or an increase in serious, irreversible, or incapacitating irreversible illness. Now, many of the hazardous air pollutants are considered to be non-threshold pollutants, meaning that no human exposure to them is safe. One thing to keep in mind is that enforcement of emission standards for hazardous air pollutants holds a significant possibility of causing economic dislocation through the cost of impossibility of compliance. The 1990 amendments, as previously mentioned, forewent the harm-based criteria due to the EPA's foot dragging and imposed a strict technology-based approach for control. Congress also set out a list of substances that they consider to be hazardous air pollutants. The term hazardous air pollutant means any air pollutant listed pursuant to subsection B of this section. This is section 7412A6. To get a better definition, we look to subsection B2, which instructs the EPA administrator to check and update the list periodically. So this says the administrator shall, doesn't have a choice here, periodically review the list chemicals, revise such list by rule, adding pollutants which present or may present through inhalation or other routes of exposure a threat of adverse human health effects, including but not limited to substances which are known to be or may reasonably be anticipated to be carcinogenic, mutagenic, teratogenic, neurotoxic, which cause reproductive dysfunction, or which are acutely or chronically toxic, or adverse environmental effects, whether through ambient concentrations, bioaccumulation, deposition, or otherwise, but not including accidental releases as a result of emissions to the air. So now we have MACT, Maximum Available Control Technology. This is an image from Total Air Pollution Control Party Limited. It's an electrostatic precipitator. It uses electricity to capture dust particles from a gas stream. So the technology-based approach Congress imposed calls for the employment of the maximum available control technology. The legislation in subsection B1 identifies almost 180 substances to be regulated by this model. Emitting sources were given 8 years to install MACT, with the EPA thereafter obligated to enact further measures to avoid unacceptable residual risks. So note, see the similarities in concept between CAA compliance with CWA compliance through the use of technology-based effluent limitations. Okay, so what are some ways that sources can lessen their emissions? Well, one thing to note is that tall emission stacks are among the least cost solutions to meet ambient air quality standards. They operate in two ways to help attain or maintain NAAQS compliance. First, they lead to wider dispersion of the pollutants they emit, which means that the concentrations of the pollutants are lower than they would be in areas near the emitting facility if shorter stacks were employed. In effect, the use of taller stacks leads to more diluted emissions that cover a wider geographical area. Second, the use of tall stacks makes possible the export of pollution beyond the boundary of the air quality control region, AQCR, the interstate or intrastate area for reaching NAAQS, turning the pollution into someone else's problem. There are also intermittent controls. Intermittent controls are employed when receiving body air quality is at or near the allowable NAAQS, and these controls are not used when receiving body conditions are favorable, i.e. when there is a low concentration of pollutants in the receiving ambient air. An example is turning off the stack filters when the local air is clean, which saves money for electricity, to run the pollution control, and money for the repair and replacement of pollution controls. The problem with this is that even though use of taller stacks and intermittent controls may meet NAAQS, it usually leads to export of pollution to another state or AQCR, which is antithetical to notions of equity and responsibility for one's own deeds. So the 77 amendments, Congress took into account the use of these techniques to meet NAAQS and limited their attractiveness. Section 7423 explicitly allows the firms to increase stack heights and to employ other dispersion techniques, defined to include intermittent controls, but the degree of emission control attributable to the excessive height of the stack or the use of dispersion techniques does not count towards meeting emissions control limitations set by the relevant SIP. So is the country's air better now? Yes, but not everywhere. The NAAQS have been attained mostly, but not in some areas. There are non-attainment areas. There has not been an explicit systematic study of the characteristics of non-containment areas, but a typical profile would include a densely populated, urbanized area having industrial concentrations. In these non-attainment areas, even stringent air pollution reduction efforts have failed to reduce sufficiently the concentration of the relevant pollutants. Remember COVID-19 in 2020? Haha, Professor, it is never ending. Yes, indeed. Turns out that the reduction in emissions during 2020, a behavior, not a technology change, resulted in better air quality. Here is a link to a peer-review study, one of a number that examined the, albeit short-term, change in air quality as a result of COVID-19, documented changes in air quality. So what to do with non-attainment areas? Now, Congress can order a total ban on all new development as a means of avoiding additional pollution to already unsafe air. Congress could also force the discontinuing of existing activities in an effort to provide the desired health benefits. But that is political suicide, and Congress has chosen not to treat non-attainment areas this severely. So what did Congress do? In the 77 amendments, Congress insisted that non-attainment areas make reasonable further progress towards attainment. This means that non-attainment areas must make annual incremental reductions in emissions of the applicable air pollutant, including substantial reductions in the early years following approval or promulgation of plan provisions and regular reductions thereafter, to provide for attainment by the set date. Please note that the set date varied depending on what criteria pollutant was employed, but, yes, you can laugh now, in no case later than December 31st, 1987. And as we have continually noted, these set dates have been moved back continually. So here is a map. It's from 2019, and it's from the Environmental Protection Agency showing counties designated non-attainment across the United States. It includes Puerto Rico and Alaska and Hawaii. Barely. All right, so different areas have different designations, and this is Section 7472. Class 1 includes international parks, national wilderness areas which exceed 5,000 acres in size, national memorial parks which exceed 5,000 acres in size, and national parks which exceed 6,000 acres in size and which are in existence on August 7, 1977. It is important to note that a Class 1 area can never be downgraded. Class 2 includes all areas in such state designated as attainment or unclassifiable, which are not established as Class 1, shall be Class 2 areas unless redesignated under Section 7474 of this title. So can an area be redesignated? Well, yes, we just found that out under Section 7474. A state may redesignate such areas as it deems appropriate as Class 1 areas, an improving designation. Areas restricted to being classified only as Class 1 or Class 2 are an area which exceeds 10,000 acres in size and is a national monument, a national primitive area, a national preserve, a national recreation area, a national wild and scenic river, a national wildlife refuge, a national lakeshore or seashore, and a national park or national wilderness area established after August 7, 1977, which exceeds 10,000 acres in size. And you can keep reading that. All right, so we have all these, you know, what areas should be Class 1. So what is a real-world example of whether redesignation can be pursued? 15 years ago, a coal-fired power plant in the Everglades agricultural area was on the planning books. At the time, the Miccosukee Tribe of Indians started the process to apply for Class 1 designation. This was never completed because the coal-fired plant was killed by Governor Charlie Crist. If the ARM Loxahatchee National Wildlife Refuge wants Class 1 CAA protection to help address potential impacts of neighboring rock mining, landfill creation, and power plant expansion, they cannot apply for this redesignation. Why? As a federal entity, they cannot engage in lobbying, especially at the state legislature level. And the redesignation process requires an application through the state legislature. Their only option? Lobbying an application through the environmental community or other such entity, like, oh, I don't know, a class of environmental law students. All right, so review of national monuments, primitive areas, and national preserves. This is Section 7474D. The federal land manager shall, has no questions here, shall review all national monuments, primitive areas, and national preserves, and shall recommend any appropriate areas for redesignation as Class 1 where air quality related values are important attributes of the area. The federal land manager shall report such recommendations with supporting analysis to the Congress and the affected states within 1 year after August 7, 1977. The federal land manager shall consult with the appropriate states before making such recommendations. So even though they said, listen, you got to do this, it still requires the federal land manager to work with the states. Now, there are four types of wiggle room. And this is netting, bubbles, offsets, and banking. And these are parts of the emissions trading program. So these are four terms that describe different parts of the emissions trading program of the Clean Air Act. It is important to understand that these emission trading devices, as they have been employed to date, have been used as an adjunct to the Clean Air Act stationary source emissions control strategies for the standard criteria pollutants. Bubbles, nettings, and offsets are related activities. Each allows a reduction in presently authorized emission of pollutants to excuse some increase in permitted emissions. The central device for emissions trading is the recognition of credit for reducing pollution below the allowable or permitted levels previously established by the Clean Air Act. Conceptually, there is little difference among the three operative programs, bubbles, netting, and offsets. All involve trading reductions in presently allowable pollution in exchange for rights to increase other emissions. The most vital distinctions among the devices lie in the context in which they are applicable and, consequently, the regulatory command and control requirements that can, at times, be avoided by the use of emission trades. So, netting. Netting allows a modified source to avoid the most stringent emission limits that would be applied to the modification by reducing emissions from another source within the same plant. Netting involves internal trading only. Netting is controlled at the state level. Netting is popular because it allows firms to avoid command and control technology-based standards for modified sources in both attainment and non-attainment areas. Firms realize additional savings by avoiding the costs and delays associated with the permitting process. Netting has the most significant environmental downside of the various emission trading devices. Unlike bubbles and offsets, netting can, and often does, result in new increases in emissions. Then we have offsets. Offsets are used by new and modified sources in non-attainment areas and by certain specified sources in attainment areas. The Clean Air Act specifies that no new emission sources would be allowed in areas that did not meet the original 1975 air quality deadlines. Well, in 1975, the EPA instituted an offset rule. It requires new and modified emission sources in these areas to obtain emission credits from sources in the same area to offset their new emissions. It's still subject to the most stringent emission limits. They may be obtained through internal or external trades, and transactions are controlled at the state level. Then we have bubbles. These were first allowed in 1979 and are used by existing sources in attainment or non-attainment areas. The name derives from the concept of placing an imaginary bubble over a multi-source plant. The levels of emission controls applied to different sources in a bubble may be adjusted to reduce control costs so long as the aggregate limit is not exceeded. In effect, emission credits are created by some sources within the plant and used by others. Originally, all bubbles had to be submitted by the states for EPA approval. In 1981, EPA began to approve generic bubble rules that enabled states to approve bubbles. Several states now have such rules. Then there's banking. This was first allowed in 1979 and provides a mechanism for firms to save emission credits for future use. EPA established guidelines for banking programs, but states must set up and administer the rules governing banking. Now we have the 1990 amendments. Now, in the 1990 amendments, Congress established a system of tradable emissions allowances designed to achieve a 10 million ton per year reduction in sulfur dioxide emissions by the year 2000. This represents more than the 50% reduction in the emission of sulfur dioxide for sources so regulated in comparison with 1980 levels. The purpose of the wholesale reduction was to combat acid rain and other forms of deposition. And noise pollution. One would think that the Clean Air Act deals with visibility, breathability, etc. Well, the Clean Air Act also encompasses quiet air, i.e. noise pollution. Subchapter 4, Section 6741 deals with noise pollution. It creates the Office of Noise Abatement and Control. The administrator shall establish within the Environmental Protection Agency an Office of Noise Abatement and Control and shall carry through such office a full and complete investigation and study of noise and its effect on the public health and welfare in order to identify and classify causes, sources to determine what psychological and physiological effects noise has on humans, what kind of noise growth is expected in urban areas, if sporadic extreme noise affects humans differently than constant noise, what effects noise has on wildlife and property values, and what are the effects of sonic booms on property values. Now, living in Florida, guys, sonic booms are important, especially when we used to have the shuttle program, and we still have, rockets that take off on the Space Coast. So subsection C requires all federal agencies to employ noise abatement strategies whenever the administrator determines the federal activity is causing objectionable amounts of noise. Can you think of any noise pollution sources? There is, of course, cars and trucks in urban and suburban areas. Construction activities is another source. Areas around airports, train depots, bus depots, and garbage dumps have increased vehicle traffic that causes a lot of noise. Another newer source of noise pollution is wind turbines. Yes, indeed, clean electricity production won't put chemicals and particulates in the air, but turbines create a low persistent hum. The New York Times reported on wind turbine noise complaints as far back as 2010. The World Health Organization put out a statement in 2018 that wind turbine noise is a health hazard, as reported by Master Resource, a free market energy blog. Now, a huge noise complaint are fire truck and ambulance sirens. I grew up in a suburb, and fire sirens are loud and get tunneled down streets. Think Doppler effect here. One thing New Yorkers love to do is complain. Yes, indeed. We have raised it to an art form. In New York City back in 2017, Mount Sinai Hospital changed the sirens on its ambulances from blaring screech to the high-low tones used in Europe. No, you're not imagining it. Some New York City ambulances sound different. Yes, indeed. Now, that experiment made an impact. In February 2019, two New York City lawmakers introduced a bill to change the long droning siren from police cars, fire trucks, and ambulance that have been part of the city's soundtrack for generations. Okay, would be replaced by a high-low wail similar to what's heard on the streets of London and Paris. Wee wee wee. I know, I sound like a minion now. So this is Sounds of Silence, noise-weary New York ponders European-style emergency vehicle alarm. So where has this bill gone since we're now in 2023? Well, the 2019 bill died in committee. A bill was introduced in the New York State Senate for the 2021-2022 legislative session, but that died in committee as well. As of January 23, 2023, it has been reintroduced at the state legislature level and assigned to committee again. Considering how loud New York City truly is, and for those who have not had the chance to visit, trust me when I tell you there is a reason Frank Sinatra sang that it is the city that never sleeps, because you can't with all the noise. There are scientists who put up sensors around Manhattan to record snippets of sound, i.e. 10-second increments, and then determine what specific sounds were in those snippets to determine how much noise there really is and at what decibel levels as well. The goal is to help the city's Department of Environmental Protection mitigate against noise pollution. So that is still ongoing, guys. The CAA focus. In looking at the Clean Air Act, one would think that it would deal with visibility, breathability, and the like. But as Section 7641 shows us, noise is considered a part of air pollution. It is interesting to think about considering the number of cars, trucks, buses, TVs, radios, cell phones, etc. that everyone is always plugged into. Is there really any place that isn't invaded by human-generated noise? Next class, we'll pick up with Title II of the CAA, which deals with motor vehicles, and we'll also discuss some recent CAA-related changes.